This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. We begin today in the English town of Bolton. You may know of it. It's rather near Wigan, not far from Ashton-under-Lyne.
It's just a very simple, semi-rural working town, about 20 miles north of Manchester. And it's a big leap. It is. It feels a very big leap.
That's Debbie Harrison, herself a former Bolton resident. Now she's spending considerable time in New York City with her son, Jack. He's the reason for the big leap, which started as a couple of little baby steps nearly 19 years ago when Jack demonstrated an affinity for soccer.
He was walking at 9 months old, and so he, by the time he was 18 months, 2 years, he used to walk around with this little ball. In fact, I've got a photograph of him somewhere with the ball in his mouth. He was just hilarious. And then he even used to go to bed with his ball, and he used to sleepwalk all the time. He's still quite a big sleepwalker, but I used to find him wandering about looking for his ball during the night, and as soon as he got up, he would dribble to the bathroom with his ball at his feet.
Such talent does not go unnoted in England. The local pro team, Bolton Wanderers, caught on to Jack when he was about 5. By the time he was 8, Manchester United had scooped him into their youth academy, which was, not surprisingly, fine with Jack, who was too young for skepticism. The same couldn't be said for Debbie.
So many people said when he was little that there was something there, but I always feel becoming a professional soccer player is a bit like winning the lottery, I suppose. I always felt that education came first.
It wasn't that there was any danger of Jack's education off the pitch ending when he was 8. The players in the academy still attended school, but mostly, as Jack recalls, they were obsessed with a game they call football.
I remember I'd play football on the weekends, I'd have a game, and then I'd go out and play with my friends afterwards as well on the park. So I just loved to play, and I think I just kind of left it in the hands of my mom to try and figure out what was best for me.
Mom could see that motivation wasn't an issue, but numbers were, or so Debbie concluded when she saw how the system worked.
As he progressed through the academy, I could see that there were boys that they come in there and they just think that football is the be-all and end-all, and that's their focus and that's the drive. But a lot of them, again, were dropped at the age of 14. And when you dropped, it's where do you go from there? What else do they have?
Mom decided there ought to be a plan B, just in case ascending to the first team at Manchester United didn't work out.
I just heard, and I did a lot of research, a lot of reading about what you could achieve in the US academically. And so that's the line that I pursued and tried to educate Jack on that along the way.
Which can't have been easy. I mean, here's a fellow who's been hearing since he was 5 that he could play pro soccer in one of the countries where it's played best. Why would he want to go to the US where football means something else entirely?
I was really apprehensive when she first kind of introduced the idea. You know, like every other kid in the academy, they just want to make it to the first team, and no kids really think about anything else.
But Debbie persisted, gently. She found that the Berkshire School in Massachusetts would provide 14-year-old Jack with the opportunity to play soccer and prepare for a college education. She told him that if he didn't like the place after he'd visited for a few days, he could stay home and they'd work out another plan. Happily for Debbie, the first visit 5 years ago went well. It's perhaps useful to pause for a moment here to consider just how preposterous this plotline has become. According to what Jack and his mom were able to learn, he was the second boy ever to have bailed out on the academy at Manchester United of his own accord. Ever. It simply wasn't done. This accounted for the response Jack got when he told his mates where he was going.
There was a lot of encouragement, but at the same time, there was a lot of questioning as well. A lot of my friends would say, why would I go to America to play football?
So at 14, Jack left home to actually enroll at the Berkshire School.
I remember when I took him to the airport and these two beautiful, glamorous air hostesses from Virgin came to him and whisked him away because he was travelling as an unaccompanied minor. And I was walking behind him and these ladies, and I just felt bedraggled because we'd driven as well for about 5 hours through the night. And he turned round and he looked at me and he went, "What are you doing, Mum?" And I said, "Oh, what, do you not want me to come?" And he said,
no, he said, I'm fine.
And I guess.
Off he toddled with these two women. And he went up the escalator and he turned around and looked at me. And then he sent me a text message when he got to the top of the escalator and he said, now you're crying, Mum. And I said, no, I'm not. And then he just waved at me and off he went.
When he arrived in the US, Jack was a bit surprised to find an opportunity to play a game quite different from the one he played at the Academy in Manchester.
Everything was so regimented and it's almost a lot of structured football. And I felt like when I came to America, everything just kind of opened up and I was able to just have more confidence and just express myself a little bit more.
Jack Harrison expressed himself well enough at Berkshire to earn an athletic scholarship to Wake Forest. In his first year there, he impressed Major League Soccer scouts enough to become the first pick in the league's 2016 draft. It was an opportunity he and his mother felt he couldn't turn down. He ended up on the roster of NYC FC, where he joined fellow Brit Frank Lampard. Lampard had starred for Chelsea, one of the Premiership's wealthiest and most successful clubs. He'd played for England as well, and to lots of boys Jack's age, he was a hero. Jack was recovering from an injury when he joined NYC FC, and soon he had some company in that regard, Lampard himself.
I've always said that soccer brings guys together, and with me not being able to play soccer, just being sat on the sidelines, it was much harder than what I expected. And he really helped out a lot with that, because only after preseason he picked up an injury, and the next thing we were doing rehab together at the same time. So I just remember at the start of the year just being on the bikes next to each other, and I was just starstruck by it, really. I wasn't sure whether to start a conversation with him or anything, and I was just looking at him and comparing my thighs to his thighs, which are much, much bigger. And but he gave me some advice on things here and there. He didn't know I was a Liverpool fan. Maybe that's why he was nice to me as well.
This season, Harrison and Lampard played alongside each other, the latter toward the end of his career, the former just getting started. NYCFC enjoyed a fine run, finishing second in the Eastern Conference before being bounced from the playoffs. Jack scored four times and logged seven assists. He finished third in the voting for Rookie of the Year. So you have to wonder if Manchester United, currently sitting a disappointing sixth in the Premiership, wishes he'd stayed put. If Jack still has any second thoughts, he's not letting on.
I mean, it was a tough decision for us both, but I think at the end of the day, I can say that, you know, I'm happy that we made the decision to even come out to the US in the first place. If you'd asked me a couple of years ago, I kept pondering the fact what would have happened if I'd have stayed at United. But I think now I can happily say that I'm happy to be where I am.
Sometimes I think to myself, and I have thought to myself, what's going on and what am I doing? But it's a dream come true. You know, it's just so, I have to pinch myself sometimes.
Especially when she's walking around New York, I find herself just kind of gazing up and not really looking where she's going.
She's like, oh, Jack, the New Yorker's shouting at me for not looking where I'm going, and yeah. I get told off a lot.
Yeah, and you're famous now as well. Everyone knows her as Mumsy. So for the games, I usually get her a ticket to go in the family section and can just kind of have a nice calm evening watching a game of soccer and stuff, but she wanders off into the fan section and she's on the drums and everything, and she really enjoys the games. So I'm happy she's able to do that.
As I listened to all that dream come true sort of stuff, I almost forgot to ask about the other part of Debbie Harrison's original motivation to look for opportunities in the U.S., the education. She didn't forget. She made sure there was a clause in Jack's contract obliging the club to pay for the remainder of the time it'll take him to earn a degree from Wake Forest, no matter when that time may come. He could be 26 when he goes back to school, she told me. He could be 56. Jack, forget the soccer. You lucked out and got the perfect mom.
Yeah.
he won't agree with you, I don't think. No.
Yeah, but Debbie, I think he just did. Last weekend, the Yale football team beat the team from Harvard in the game, capital T, capital G. That wasn't supposed to happen. Before the game, Harvard was on track to win a share of the Ivy League title once again, and Yale had only two wins. A few days before the game, a young friend of mine who recently graduated from Harvard asked if I would be going. I told him that as an undergraduate at Yale, I'd gone to one Yale-Harvard game. I'd driven to Cambridge to do it. I spent the weekend with a friend who was a Harvard student, and he didn't go. On that day, almost 50 years ago, I sat at the top of the stadium where the cold wind rules. I left at halftime hoping to save my toes, which I could no longer feel. I hobbled back to my friend's dormitory room in a building named, believe it or not, Wigglesworth. I haven't gone to the game since. After Yale won last weekend's edition of the game, my friend, the young Harvard graduate, emailed me as follows, "Sometimes even a blind squirrel finds an acorn." I work with a guy. I knew he was kidding. Then I got another email from a guy I had known at Yale, and he had also gone to Saturday's game. Maybe when we were undergraduates, he'd had warmer shoes. I sent him the blind squirrel comment, and he got right back to me. As I was walking out of the stadium, he wrote, "A guy who noticed my Yale cap stopped me, and he said, 'Congratulations.' I'm thankful that I wasn't at the game. It was cold, I was warm, traffic, and so on. And I'm thankful for the little story about the Harvard guy congratulating the Yale guy. The Harvard guy must have been disappointed. Winning would have meant something to his team. They'd have been Ivy League co-champs. Good on him for the congratulations. But I'm also thankful for the comment about the blind squirrel and the acorn. How do we get through some of the things we have to get through without that sort of thing, without the one-liner that spits in the eye of disappointment and laughs? I think maybe I don't. It's the blind squirrel and the acorn stuff that helps keep everything else in perspective so that I don't take either the wins or the losses on or off the field more seriously than they need to be taken. It's Thanksgiving weekend. You two guys who emailed me after last Saturday's game, thanks to both of you." Long before Charles Haley was crushing NFL quarterbacks, he was being crushed by mental illness.
I never felt part of anything. I never felt part of my family. I didn't have friends. I didn't understand the things that were going on in my head at the time. Life was totally hell.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. We have lots more coming up on Only a Game, but first, I'd like to thank Patty Lou 52, who left this review of our podcast. Refreshing, smart, sometimes moving, often funny. I look forward to each new episode. Patty Lou 52, thanks to you for the new review. You see what I did there? Consider a review of your own on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. The music you're hearing is what the gathered dignitaries in Las Vegas heard this week when they were supposed to be watching a video announcement for the city's new NHL team, the Vegas Golden Knights. In addition to the bonanza-type music, the screen simply read, "Placeholder, Vegas Hockey." Owner Bill Foley was compelled to think quickly.
"We're going to do better than that on the rink, I'll tell you that."
And that is where we will begin this week's three stories you should know. Joining me this time around are Sports on Earth's Will Leach via Skype and the Boston Globe and WBUR, Shira Springer. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, yes.
As I just mentioned, the NHL team that will play in Las Vegas will be called the Vegas Golden Knights. I was disappointed. I was rooting for the Snake Eyes, but okay. The slot machines would have worked too. Some questions do arise. First, will the arrival of the NHL in Las Vegas turn out to be merely the first part of what will be a three-ring circus in the desert featuring the NBA and, of course, most significantly, the National Football League? And if that does happen, will those expansions or relocations indicate that all three leagues have signed on to the proposition that since gambling on sports is inevitable, they better get a piece of the action? Will, you want to pick up on that?
Placeholder only a game commentary. Placeholder only a game commentary. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, sorry. Yes. Sports no longer feels obliged to pretend that this isn't a major part of the reason that people watch them. And we can argue whether that's a good thing or whether that's a bad thing. The idea of Vegas having a team, that is now the least of the things that are involved with sports and gambling. So while I agree it seems a little strange, I feel like that ship has sailed.
I am right there with you, Will. That ship has sailed. And as far as this being the start of a three-ring circus with the NBA and the NFL to follow, I think you're exactly right, Bill. Those two other leagues are coming, and probably sooner rather than later. This is sort of, in some ways, a trial balloon, the NHL is, to see how the city responds. They have had a little bit of a trial with the NBA Summer League, but that's 2 weeks in July, which is sort of the dead season for tourism in Las Vegas. The NHL will be during the high season.
I have no personal stake in the relationship between gambling and sports. I gave up betting on games a long time ago because I realized I wasn't any good at it. On principle, I'm against anything that might further enrich the National Football League and render it even more hypocritical than it already is. So I'm going to have to study this issue to find out precisely what my position is. But Will, take us away from all this misery.
I can't guarantee I can do that, but certainly I will talk about Jurgen Klinsmann and the U.S. soccer team. Jurgen Klinsmann was fired as the technical director and coach of the U.S. men's soccer team after a terrible start to the hexagonal round of qualifying for the World Cup in 2018 in Russia. Klinsmann's been the coach for a while, and they did okay at the last World Cup. But one of the major reasons that Klinsmann was brought in the first place was to change the culture of U.S. soccer. Mm-hmm. And one of the major things that Klinsmann has done is gone throughout the youth leagues and tried to de-emphasize the value of the coach. He's trying to say trust players' instinct. The way that for the U.S. to progress in soccer and to play like the rest of the world in soccer and to value the amount of talent that they do have is to stop trying to coach them all the time in these youth leagues. Let players create. Let players learn. This is a fantastic instinct, not just in soccer, but frankly in all of youth sports. It is, however, a terrible instinct when you're coaching the U.S. men's soccer team. I think in like 20 years, we will appreciate Jurgen Klinsmann, but I think it was hard to argue that it wasn't the right move, at least for right now.
Will is absolutely right. What Klinsmann did for the development system will pay dividends. However, Klinsmann was unable to solve a problem that has been difficult for those who have preceded him, and that's how to get more soccer players from the inner city. I think U.S. soccer officials are always saying development-wise, why can't we have kids playing soccer in the streets the way they play basketball? I'm curious to see if they'll be able to solve that riddle down the line with a new coach/technical director.
I wonder if we're not overcomplicating this.
We probably are.
The fate of soccer coaches, it seems to me, is no different from the fate of people who coach in other sports. The best of them do well for a while, and then for whatever constellation of reasons, they lose the team, the players stop paying attention, and the coach gets fired. And it happened to Jurgen Klinsmann. It happened to Bruce Arena as well, who's coming back to coach the U.S. team. And I wish him good luck going forward. I certainly hope he can qualify for the World Cup. Will, you want to wrap this up for us?
I think that's ultimately progress when we are firing coaches at the rate of the rest of the world. America has made it. We've made our step forward.
All right, Shira, we're going to go from international competition between men who sometimes act like teenagers to an actual game played by actual teenagers, right?
Yeah. This week, a football controversy in Illinois caught my attention. Plainfield North High School needed a favorable ruling from a Cook County judge to secure its spot in the Class 7A state title game. Why, you may ask? Well, with no time left in the semifinal between Plainfield North and Fenwick High, an officiating mistake allowed Plainfield North to kick a game-tying field goal. Then, Plainfield North won the game in overtime on a two-point conversion. Now, the Illinois High School Association admitted that the game's officials had made a bad call, and the association's executive director apologized, but Fenwick, of course, wanted more than an apology, and they took the matter to court. The judge rejected Fenwick's legal challenge. And this made me think, bad calls happen all the time in sports, but you can't have parents or coaches or school administrators rushing to the courthouse every time there's a bad call. The court dockets would be overflowing if that was the case. And I think there was a real missed opportunity here to teach the kids some life lessons.
You know, I remember my grandfather was an umpire. He umpired high school games for years and years and years. There was a really close play at home plate. And he called the man safe. And the catcher ran up to him. He says, no, he wasn't. He was out. And my grandfather said, no, he's safe because I said he was safe and I am the umpire. And we feel as if when we are watching these games, we can find some sort of objective truth, whether it's replay or whether it's we get to super slow-mo or there's a booth in New York that can tell us what the right call actually was. This is what happens when you undermine, a lot of times with good reason and with good thought, undermine the idea of there is an overriding authority on the field, and that person is the umpire and the referee. Sometimes they are wrong, but that does not matter because there has to be an authority on the field.
The players on both sides of this issue should be told to go study for their final exams, and the parents should all be told to get lives which are not so dependent on whether their kids' football teams win or lose.
Agreed.
It's ridiculous.
Agreed.
My guests for this week's three stories you should know have been Sports on Earth's Will Leach and WBUR and the Boston Globe, Shira Springer. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sometimes we think we know the star athletes we watch, but often we don't. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story of Football Hall of Famer Charles Haley.
I played in the National Football League for 12 years. I'm the only man with 5 Super Bowl rings. I get a little lightheaded because I'm on top of that mountain by myself.
Charles Haley is 6'5". His playing weight was 250 pounds. But it was the defensive end's speed, agility, and violence that terrified quarterbacks of the 80s and 90s.
Out of bounds by Charles Haley.
Knocked out of bounds. He was darn near knocked out of the stadium.
Watching Haley terrified me a little bit. He was always the most intimidating player on the field, and he seemed to revel in it. He crushed quarterbacks and taunted opponents without mercy. But growing up in Gladys, Virginia, he was anything but fearsome.
As far as the sports and stuff, you know, I was always a short, fat kid, and I was a clown. I never knew how to work hard.
Haley's parents each worked 2 jobs to support their family of 7. At the urging of his mother, Haley began playing sports with his brothers. But the young Charles began to suspect that something wasn't quite right.
I never felt part of anything. I never felt part of my family. I didn't have friends. Me and my brothers fought all the time. They used to beat me up a lot, and I'm 9 or 10, and we were playing basketball, and nobody would pick me to be on that team, and life was totally hell. And, you know, I had no hopes, no dreams, no aspirations. I just got tired of life. It drained me. I didn't understand the things that were going on in my head at the time. And I said, God, I don't know what's going on. I can't take this no more. Please help me. Just give me something, anything. Just give me something to be great at. Give me some reason to get up in the morning and push myself. And, you know, he did.
Haley applied himself to football. And in his early teens, he grew 4 or 5 inches.
I took off in JV in 9th grade, I guess. I never came off the field. I played inside linebacker, tight end, got kicked off. I did it all, and it was the best time of my life. I became better than my brothers. I overcame a lot of things. Going from a kid that didn't want to live anymore to where that light was so bright that nobody could darken it, no matter what.
But that light would only shine some of the time. Haley experienced extreme mood swings. He didn't realize that he was suffering from a medical condition, and it only got worse. That sense of isolation he felt as a young kid followed him through high school, and he would have been even lonelier if he hadn't been so good on the gridiron.
I was expelled more than I was in school. They would expel me on Monday, bring me back on Friday to play in the game. And then I'll finish up my expulsion the next week. It was crazy.
As a senior, Haley led his high school team to the district championship. He was defensive player of the year, but he was not highly recruited. So he accepted the only offer he got from a Division I school nearby James Madison University. He excelled at JMU and was taken by San Francisco in the fourth round of the 1986 NFL Draft.
It was disbelief. And then I went to California. Oh, my God. I got off the plane, and I asked this white guy, I said, where do I go for bags claim? He turned around and was speaking a different language. And then I asked this black guy. He turned and thought speaking a different language. And I went back to the gate, and I sat there waiting on that plane to come because I wanted to go back home. I was so afraid.
Haley stayed in San Francisco and soon began to establish himself as a dominant defensive lineman. But he often clashed with teammates and coaches, many of whom were afraid of him. He got married after his rookie season. His wife, Karen, though not a doctor, tried to make sense of her husband's extreme mood swings.
She diagnosed me with being manic depressant. I did not like that. I thought she just piled on top of everybody else who said that I was Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, split personalities and everything else. People always put me down, but nobody was ever giving me solutions, and I figured she just joined the bandwagon.
Haley's denial continued, even as more and more of his Niners teammates jumped on that bandwagon after they noticed his erratic behavior. And then, early in the 1991 season, the wheels came off after a loss to the Raiders. Haley entered the locker room as players and team doctors looked on.
I had a meltdown, mental breakdown. I started really losing it. I just started acting crazy, and some guys came up, tried to control me, and I started trying to fight, and I put my hand through the glass window with that wire in it, so it cut my arm and hand all up. So I'm laying there bleeding really bad, crying, and the doctors, they in the doorway looking at me. They were afraid to come over. They didn't know what's going to happen.
People tended to look the other way when Haley intimidated and fought teammates or even took a swing at his head coach. They made excuses for him because that's what sometimes happens when you have a guy on the roster who averages more than 13 sacks a season. Haley was traded to Dallas in 1992, but the change of scenery didn't help, and there was still no diagnosis. The explosive episodes, which Haley now describes as out-of-body experiences, got worse. By this time, Haley had a growing family.
My kids took me out for Father's Day, so we had a restaurant. And I never understood why they would take me anywhere, because they would talk to each other, not to me. So that day, they were playing around. They started talking about some of my dumb quirks. And I got mad, and I hit the table so hard that the people next to me got up and left. And then my kids, the fear that was in their eyes, it was terrifying. I never wanted to see my kids like that again.
Haley retired from football in 1999. A couple years later, after decades of wondering what was going on in his head, he was officially diagnosed with bipolar disorder. But prescription drugs didn't help, and he began self-medicating with painkillers and alcohol. He and his wife divorced, and Haley lost touch with his four children.
I felt like I was going into the depths of hell. I couldn't see anything positive. All I could think about is ending this. I have no reason to live.
Haley was in and out of rehab for a decade. And then in 2012, he visited the La Paloma Treatment Center in Memphis, where he says everyone, including the director, understood bipolarity and alcoholism. He found a new course of treatment, including effective medication. He's now able to control his anger, and he says he understands himself for the first time.
You know, I always tell people there are three sides of me. There's Charlie, who's a crybaby, really sensitive. And then, you know, Charles is, you know, he's stable. And then Chuck is like, no, I think I stayed in that Chuck zone too long.
Once out of the Chuck zone, Haley was able to rebuild his relationship with his children. He says he and his ex-wife are now good friends. He works with a charity that brings computers to low-income school kids. And he mentors football players. Haley says that when he learns about a player with substance abuse or mental health issues, he gets on the phone or drives to their practices. He feels he's helping and learning as he goes.
I was working with about five, six guys, and I failed. Every one of them had relapse and everything.
But I'm having success now. I think what I did wrong at the beginning, I tried to tell these guys what to do. Now, I just talk to them about me. I say, if you see any similarities in what I used to do and what you're doing now, you know you got some issues. And I tell guys, don't sit here and glorify the things I did. I want you to sit here and understand how many people I hurt through these actions.
Which is better, helping NFL players with mental health issues or being successful at football?
Winning Super Bowls, the sacrifice, the hard work, the sweat, the blood, the tears that went with that, I wouldn't trade that for nothing, because that gives me strength every day to get my butt up and walk in, hug a brother that's in the NFL or in college or in high school and tell them, you know what, I love you. You do not have to go through this alone.
For Only a Game, I'm Gary Wallach.
You can learn more about Charles Haley's story in his new book, Fear No Evil, Tackling Quarterbacks and Demons on My Way to the Hall of Fame. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Ahead on Only a Game, marathoner Steve Russolillo donated a kidney.
My life has not changed at all. I haven't given up anything. I guess I've given up a kidney, but other than that, though, I mean, I'm living the same life that I was living beforehand.
And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the story of two Rose Bowl opponents who met again on the World War II battlefield. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie,
hey,
and happy Thanksgiving weekend.
Happy Thanksgiving weekend to you and everybody who listens to this program. And I give thanks for the fact that people listen to this program.
Me too. Amidst growing criticism that NFL games have been boring this season, the league brought us three games on Turkey Day. Were any of them worth waking up out of your turkey-induced stupor to watch?
Yeah, I mean, if you're a defensive and bungling purist, the Vikings and Detroit was a pretty good game. But actually, the Cowboys and Redskins was a very entertaining game to watch, and Dak Prescott, the rookie quarterback from Dallas, along with Ezekiel Elliott, the rookie running back from Dallas, are both becoming stars in a great big hurry.
The NFL's ongoing experiment in exporting its product blossomed in Mexico on Monday night. A three-day fan fest led up to the game between the Raiders and the Texans, and the locals seemed to enjoy it.
Yeah, it's certainly a better fan base than this pie-in-the-sky notion of putting a team in London. I do like the picture of the one guy wearing the sweatshirt that says, I might live in Mexico, but my team is in New England. He's probably the least popular guy in his neighborhood. My favorite one, though, is the nickname that has been given to Andrew Luck, the Indianapolis quarterback, who is known apparently in Mexico as El Hipster, which is Spanish for the hipster.
The hipster, yes, exactly. Charlie, Notre Dame lost a bunch of games this week, but football teams only play once a week. How'd that happen?
Well, it's sort of retroactive, Bill. There was a whole bunch of academic fraud going on, and it had to vacate wins from 2012 and 2013. The school's going to appeal. They think the penalty is excessive. I think it's hilarious, but that's just me.
Ralph Branca, who gave up a famous home run to Bobby Thompson way back in 1951, spent a lot of years being a good sport about doing that. He died on Wednesday. He was 90 years old. It's unfair, I think, that Branca is remembered as the guy who gave up the home run that won the Giants the pennant back in 1951, but he never seemed to worry about it very much.
Well, the great thing about Ralph Branca's life, of course, besides how well he handled it and how staunchly he stood literally beside Jackie Robinson for Jackie Robinson's first game with
the
Dodgers, literally on the baseline, is the fact that he managed to outlive most of the people who really care about the home run he gave up.
The Robinson thing brings back a great story. His brother said, I'm worried that somebody will shoot at Robinson and hit you. And Branca said, well, that's all right. I'd die a hero.
Yeah, actually, his brother said, what if the guy's a lousy shot?
The MLS playoffs are nearing their conclusion. I like that out of the four semifinalists, three are relatively new expansion teams. So hooray for Seattle, Toronto, and Montreal.
I was going to say hooray for an original six matchup in the Eastern Conference between Toronto and Montreal.
That's right.
We're never
if only it were the NHL.
We're never going to see that in the NHL playoffs ever again because Toronto's so terrible.
I don't like it when people make fun of Major League Soccer, but this week I feel compelled to add my voice to the chorus because Tuesday night's playoff game between Montreal and Toronto was delayed because the guys painting the lines for the penalty box got it wrong. They made the penalty box the wrong size. Groundskeeper error.
Yeah, this is a real groundskeeper error. And you know the amazing thing, though, Bill? If this wasn't the MLS, but it was a FIFA-sponsored event, it would cost $85 trillion to repaint that penalty box.
I'd like to point out the terrible play of Cleveland Cavaliers forward Kevin Love. He scored just six measly points in the last three quarters of the Cavs' win on Wednesday. That's awful, right?
Well, yeah, except he went bananas in the first quarter and scored 34, which is an NBA record. He was 11 for 14 shots in the quarter, too, by the way, and was 8 for 10 from three. So, yeah, that's the way you do that thing.
As if not to be upstaged, LeBron James is the subject of a popular YouTube video.
I'm gonna take my talents to South Beach. I'm gonna go join the Miami Heat. There's a championship I haven't won. I just can't wait. Just can't wait.
When LeBron the Musical hits Broadway, I think an only a game road trip would be in order.
Well, first of all, they're going to have to go to Lin-Manuel Miranda and get the rights to the music because that music's from Hamilton. But yeah, I think LeBron the Musical, I think the concept LeBron the Musical is brilliant.
It's brilliant. Oh, no question. Finally, Charlie, I understand that Dak Prescott, the Cowboys quarterback who has sent Tony Romo to the bench, displayed significant versatility in last weekend's game. What did he do, kick a field goal?
An enormous concern for the environment. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever, you've never been, so I'll explain this to you. if you've ever been in an NFL stadium after the game. The sidelines look like the last day at Woodstock. But Dak went behind the back to throw a Gatorade cup in the trash and missed and went back and picked it up and put it in the trash just like his mother taught him. Oh. And good for you, Dak. But my favorite explanation was that he missed because there was still ice in the cup and it screwed up the rotation.
I want to know if he'll be fined by the commissioner for doing this, because I'm not sure that's part of what players are supposed to do on the field.
Well, it's already been viewed 49,000 times on YouTube, so he's pushing the limits of what's allowed as fun in the National Football League.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and of course he joins me each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
This is one of those boy meets girl stories. You know, boy meets girl, boy and girl fall in love, boy runs a marathon just months after donating a kidney. Wait, what? Only a Game's Karen Given is here to explain.
Stephen Russolillo is a daily columnist for The Wall Street Journal. A few years back, he met his now wife, Shelley Banjo. She was working at The Wall Street Journal, too. And she told him about polycystic kidney disease. It runs in her family.
It wasn't on the third date, but, it was, I would say within the first year of dating, this came up. Shelley's mom would ultimately need a transplant at some point. The timing was unknown. It could be in a year, it could be in 5 years, it could be 10 years, who knows. But this was just something that was on the horizon.
Steve says he just tried to do the things that good companions do. He listened, he comforted, he hoped for the best. Life went on. The disease progressed. Shelley's mom, Batya, got sicker. Steve and Shelley's relationship progressed, which led to happier developments.
So I proposed to Shelley in March, end of March 2015. Really, the first thought that came to mind was it has to be running related somehow. It was a Sunday morning in Central Park, and I tried to make it as normal of a run as possible. Like, hey, Shelley, let's go running this morning. Okay, fine.
How'd you hide a ring in running clothes?
So I had it in the box, and I put the box in this running jacket that I was wearing, and I thought that I caught her glancing at it, and in my head, I kind of freaked out. I was like, oh my God, she knows something's up.
Shelley didn't know. After running for about a mile, Steve stopped, got on one knee, and proposed. Shelley's sister was there to take pictures. But Batya Banjo was still getting sicker. Doctors told her it was time for a kidney transplant. The family had already started the search for a living donor.
We put a flyer out. I mean, literally, we made this flyer and Shelley posted it and posted it on Twitter. And we actually had 11 people raise their hand and went and got tested.
11 people stepped up. 11 people were medically disqualified.
Each one after the other, you get your hopes up and you get really excited. And then you get the bad news. I'm watching very interesting people step up. I'm watching complete strangers from the internet. I'm watching close friends. I watched my own aunt go and get tested. I'm sitting here thinking to myself, if all these people can raise their hands, why can't I?
Why not, Steve? I can think of one reason. Shelley might need a kidney someday. The disease runs in her family. But Steve and Shelley decided to focus on the current need rather than worry about a potential need later. So Steve went in for testing. At first, no one knew but Shelley. They didn't want to get the family's hopes up. Besides, Steve had some tough questions for the doctors.
You know, at the time, I had ran 5 marathons, 15 to 20 half marathons. I mean, this is really important to me. It was the first thing I asked them. I said, will I be able to run? And if they had said no, oh, God, I just asked myself a difficult question. I don't know how I would have responded to that. But thank God they said yes, so I don't have to answer that question now. But I wanted to know what the sacrifices were ahead of time, and this would have been a really, really huge one for me.
Steve decided the risks were minimal, and the potential reward was huge. So Steve and Shelley called Batya to tell her the news.
There was just silence at first. She was just really just speechless. She said, oh, you're my lifesaver. And, you know, it made me a little nervous at first. It's like, I didn't do anything yet. So hold on. Let's wait a second.
But it wasn't Steve who had second thoughts. It was Batya. And even though doctors said that she should have the operation right away, Batya was firm. The transplant would have to wait until after the wedding, scheduled for May 29th, 2016.
I don't know what it was. Maybe it was adrenaline or maybe it was just positive emotions, but everything leading up to the wedding, you know, she seemed to be feeling better. She did an amazing hora. We did the hora twice, actually, at the wedding, and she was amazing both times. If you didn't know anything, she seemed to be pretty much fine. But, I mean, all the medical charts would say otherwise.
3 weeks later, Steve and Shelley woke up at 4 a.m. to meet her parents in New York.
We're all dressed in sweatpants and pajamas, and there's like, you know, a little bit of a nervous tension. And Shelly's dad just turns to the doorman and goes, we're all getting ready to go play basketball. And that just like really just sort of like calmed everyone just a little bit right then and there.
Steve's operation took 90 minutes. Batya's took 3 hours. Both went well, though Steve was in more pain than he expected immediately after the surgery. But then came the moment that Steve and Batya had been waiting for.
They wheeled me over into her area. She just reached out and grabbed my hand, and I grabbed her hand, and she just said, you know, you saved my life. And it's not every day someone says that to you. And so that was just so powerful to me.
It sounds like it's still powerful to you.
Oh, I mean, absolutely.
At first, Steve, the accomplished marathon runner, says he walked so slowly that he had to find the intersections in New York City that would give him a little extra time to make it across. But Steve wanted to run.
I remember exactly 1 month after the transplant, Shelley and I did this 4-mile run in Central Park. So this was a 4-mile race. And basically, I would walk for about 10 minutes. I would very, very slowly jog for 2 or 3 minutes, and then I would just repeat the process.
Steve started to get down on himself. He worried that his road to recovery and this 4-mile race would never end.
You know, Shelley was the best. She just said, it's going to be fine. You're doing this. You're doing this a month after the transplant. That's just amazing in and of itself. Don't worry about your time. Don't worry. It doesn't matter. You're doing it. At the time, I was thinking to myself, you know, I'm going to do the marathon. I'm definitely going to do the marathon. I may not do it as fast as I'd like to do it. And I better go faster than I'm going now. But I was thinking I'm going to somehow be able to do it.
That was July 16th. Steve had less than 4 months to get ready for the New York City Marathon. Steve's doctors told him that as long as he felt good, he should keep training. And as his runs got longer and faster, Steve's wife had some more specific advice.
Oh, man, Shelley, she kept telling me, she said, don't run faster than an 8-minute mile. Don't run faster than it all. And, you know, some of these shorter runs, I'm like, oh, but I feel good. Like, come on, just let me go. And she said, no, don't do it.
With each passing long run, Steve felt better. He felt stronger. Before he knew it, November 6th had arrived. Bright and sunny, temperatures in the mid-50s, it was a beautiful day for a marathon. But Steve had memories of other races running through his mind.
As most runners do, I usually hit the wall at mile 18, 19, or 20, and the last quarter of the marathon is a disaster or whatever. And so I'm running this, and I have Shelley's voice in my head the whole time saying, make sure you stay on your pace, stay on that 8-minute pace.
But by mile 12 or 13, Steve got frustrated with going so slowly. He started running faster.
Mile 15 and 16, you go over the Queensboro Bridge. That's the one spot in the marathon where there are basically no spectators at all. So all you're hearing is just the footsteps and people breathing, and that's it. You know, get over the bridge, get into Manhattan. It's just so loud and there's so much energy. And I start seeing a lot of my friends. I'm feeling really good. And I get to, you know, mile 19, mile 20. And I'm thinking to myself, this is the spot that I usually just really, really start falling apart. But the opposite was happening. I was actually feeling stronger. I don't know what it was. I guess just all these emotions from everything, from the wedding, from the honeymoon, from the transplant, from the recovery, just everything. All these emotions were all bottled up into this one race. Letting them go and just running it, just I felt amazing. And like I crossed the finish line and I was so pumped up. You know, I mean, I'm usually dead after a marathon, usually just so exhausted. And I don't know, I just felt absolutely amazing.
Just 5 months after donating his kidney, Steve had run a personal best. And his mother-in-law is doing well, too. She followed his run online from her home in Texas. The National Kidney Foundation says 13 people die every day waiting for a kidney, and living donor rates have fallen over the past decade. But Steve Russolillo hopes that if people hear his story, maybe they'll help reverse that trend.
It's funny, I have this amazing group of friends, and we all do this Hoboken Thanksgiving together. We have this tradition every year, everyone goes around and says what they're thankful for. You know, I was reliving the story again, and it's more powerful than ever because I know how important it is, but at the end of the day, it was not that big of a sacrifice for me. My life has not changed at all. I haven't given up anything. I guess I've given up a kidney, but other than that, though, I mean, I'm living the same life that I was living beforehand. The fact that I could do this whole transplant and feel as well as I did and run as well as I did, other people can get out there and other people can donate and other people can run a marathon afterward and it'll be totally fine.
All right, but you are not saying that donating a kidney will make you a faster runner,
no,
right?
No, that's right. Yeah, there's the causation correlation. You know, I got to think about that.
That's Only a Game's Karen Given speaking with Steven Russolillo. His story, My Wife's Mother Needed a Kidney and I Was a Match, first appeared in the Wall Street Journal. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Jeremy Relosa. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Steve Russolillo, who calls his mother-in-law the glue that holds the family together.
Her husband, Chaim, forgets the punchline of a joke, and she jumps in and completes it for him.
That sounds to me like a great stand-up act, doesn't it? And I can picture their names and lights, Chaim and Batya Banjo. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game, and thanks for listening.